I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, Freedom Park.
The slogan there was No Road. And each of the neighborhoods had that as their slogan. No neighborhood was going to sell out another neighborhood. What was bad for Druid Hills was bad for Candler Park, was bad for Inman Park. And I think that that was the most important aspect of the whole fight, was that we could maintain a cohesive spirit amongst the neighbors in the fight against the politicians and all of the powers that be in the Department of Transportation.
We're going to do things a little differently today on Sidewalk Radio by venturing out into the street. Actually, onto a parkway, if we're going to be precise. As always, of course, we'll look both ways before proceeding, both into the past and into the future of Freedom Park. The story begins in 1961.
In 1961? Was it that long ago?
I think so.
Okay. Well, you know, GDOT, Georgia Department of Transportation, is in the business of solving transportation problems, and traditionally they do that by building roads. And Atlanta, sprawling metropolis, and GDOT saw its mission to basically build more and bigger roads leading from the suburbs where people lived to downtown where the jobs were. And as part of that, they had a couple, you know, Georgia 400 was one of those proposals. The other one was to build I-45, which would basically come right through Inman Park, right through Candler Park, right through Druid Hills and head out and connect to Stone Mountain Freeway.
So it was a highway that was going to bisect the city from north to south, and then the Stone Mountain Toll Road was bisecting the city east to west, and they were all joining in a huge clover leaf about the size of Spaghetti Junction in the middle of where the Carter Center is now.
So we'd have another interstate pretty much running through the heart of the city. The communities got together, and they fought extremely hard to oppose that. And they were able actually to win a war with GDOT, which is not an easy thing to do. And the compromise was to build what is now Freedom Parkway, which is a much scaled down version of what I-45 would have been, and then to lease the land adjoining it to the city of Atlanta as parkland.
Please, driver, drive around the park again. I'm all alone tonight, though it's wrong, I know, to miss her so. No one else would seem quite right. So, please, driver, once around the park again. You've heard this tale before. I could call some friend, but why pretend? In the end, I'd miss her more.
My guests today are Kathy Bradshaw, the former president of neighborhood activist group Caution.
Oh, I guess I should say that Caution stands for Citizens Against Unnecessary Thoroughfares in Older Neighborhoods.
George Dusenberry, City of Atlanta Commissioner of Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Affairs.
Nice, I hate the word nice. People always say, oh, well, parks are nice. I said, well, parks are beyond nice, and art is beyond nice. It's a substantial contributor to your quality of life. There was a recent study talking about what drives quality of life in a community, and what are businesses interested in seeing communities where they want to relocate in terms of that quality of life. Number one was arts and culture. Number two was parks.
Patricia Curlin, an architect and representative of Atlanta Public Arts Legacy Fund.
As you're coming south on Freedom Parkway, entering into the city of Atlanta, the piece becomes kind of a gateway on the eastern edge of the city, with the tall skyscrapers in the background. The placement of the sculpture is extremely important. So how people are going to see it, if they're going to be able to approach it or come up, if it's a monolithic piece, should it be up higher, should it be down at the ground, should it be accessible?
And the president of the Freedom Park Conservancy, David Blackley.
We started to discuss the fact that we're no longer fighting a road, we're advocating for a park. And so we changed the name of the organization then to Freedom Park Conservancy. I think it was in 96, 97, right in there. And from then on, of course, we've been advocating for a park.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Freedom Park.
Well, I think it's important to the history of Atlanta to know how in-town neighborhoods came together and fought against City Hall and state government, state transportation department, federal Department of Transportation, as well as a former governor and former ambassador. And we were able to reach an agreement that worked in the favor of the neighborhoods. Caution was an organization that was formed in 1982 after Jimmy Carter left office as president of the U.S. and came back to Atlanta looking for a place to build his library, the presidential library. And because the land had been cleared with U.S. Department of Transportation funds, they had to have some type of road access in order for the library to be a part of a federal park. But it was a high-speed road. It was an interstate. It was going to put a lot of traffic through the neighborhoods. There were seven bridges, one over Highland Avenue, one over Moreland Avenue, one over the park in Candler Park, and at Ponce de Leon. And so it would mean access ramps and all of the high speed that an interstate allows. But part of the Presidential Parkway plan was going to have what Young and his designers called tot lots, which were going to be right next to the high-speed traffic. And we didn't really see this
as...
Is
a tot lot what it sounds like?
Like a playground for children.
Okay.
Yes. Next to their amenities of narrow bike jog paths. And there were just a lot of features to this that was going to destroy the in-town neighborhoods.
I do think it was... there was a social movement. I think there... I mean, I was a former executive director for Park Pride, and we made a conscious effort to get people involved in their parks and to kind of take some ownership and improve them. And it's, you know, when people have that sense of ownership, they're going to treat it better, they're going to invest more into it, they're going to come to it more often. And just getting together and talking and learning what worked in their communities, what doesn't work in their communities, supporting each other. And when you start doing that, the elected officials start to notice.
One politician who answered the call was then councilman and now congressman John Lewis. Echoing his involvement in the civil rights movement, Councilman Lewis urged citizens to practice in nonviolent protest against the road construction project. His effort would later be honored by renowned folk artist Thornton Dial with a sculpture called The Bridge. But most politicians, like then-Mayor Andy Young, saw more potential in a new highway than in the still recovering historic neighborhoods like Inman Park.
Well, the in-town neighborhoods were not prospering in the 60s, so it didn't appear to be anything of value to the city developers or politicians. And Inman Park, the old Fourth Ward, Candler Park, had seen a lot of people leaving for other neighborhoods north of the city. Inman Park really had a lot of people leaving after World War II, and that's when a lot of the smaller houses were built in Inman Park, when a lot of the big Victorians were subdivided into many units, each room an apartment in some of the houses. So by the time DOT was developing plans, it was just a line on a map. They didn't have any concern about building an expressway through in-town neighborhoods. We were not on a historic register. We were not viewed as having value. And even though our politicians didn't always consider it to be of value, those of us who were living there certainly saw that it had value. And not just monetary, but for in-town living, for raising a family, having creating a good neighborhood to live in.
As the fight continued, Kathy and Caution took to the streets and to the trees.
Now, there actually were two forms of protest going on. The Roadbusters were formed as more of the civil disobedience arm of the protest. The biggest protest came when they started to cut down trees in Candler Park. I remember Danny Fig Sandoval climbing a tree, and we got a report. You know, I think it was 7 o'clock in the morning. There was frost. It was a cold morning. And he and several others climbed the tree in Candler Park, and we kept that tree from being cut down. The Roadbusters also had protest in one of the parks along Ponce de Leon, where the road was going to wipe out one of the Olmsted parks. And that protest lasted for many months. I can't quite remember, but maybe as long as a year. We have great old footage from the newscast of the tree, one of the dogwoods being cut down, and Paige Harvey and I think Bruce McLaughlin in the tree as it's coming to the ground, and DOT using their powers of eminent domain to cut down the trees. Through the years, there were probably 30, 40 people arrested. I put up the deed to our house one time to bail somebody out of jail, and, you know, where one person could get arrested, another couldn't, and so they would offer their deed to their house or post the bond or whatever. Well, we, of course, hoped that we were going to have total victory. We never knew that it was going to last as many years and have as many lawsuits and have to raise as much money, but I think over the 10 or so years that I was involved in caution, we ended up raising over $900,000, and I have never counted the number of lawsuits, but we went to Fulton County Superior Court, the DeKalb County Superior Court, State Court, the Supreme Court of Georgia, and we just never anticipated that we were going to have that many battles along the way, but the neighborhood's never lost momentum. We one of the rallies, which is phenomenal for me to think about now with trying to replicate it. But we had over 3,000 people attend a hearing at the Civic Center in 1983 when the Georgia Department of Transportation had a public hearing on the environmental impact of the road on the neighborhoods. And we did all this before cell phones, before email. We flyered homes. We had phone trees where we called one person and they would call five more people. And we were able to spread the word somehow and get 3,000 people to show up at a rally. And I can't imagine doing that now with even with cell phones and email. I can't think what would bring 3,000 people out to the Civic Center.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, Freedom Park, brought to you by Perkins & Will. The road, which is called Freedom Parkway, and the park next to it, Freedom Park, really started to be built in earnest in 1992. Unfortunately, because the Department of Transportation really wasn't known for creating beauty in their parkways, the plan wasn't all that great. And it was kind of by chance that David Blackley, who now serves as the president of the Freedom Park Conservancy, an organization that had evolved from caution, was down at City Hall.
I happened to be down to the DOT one day for another project.
And saw these plans laying there.
One of the young engineers showed me the plans for what was going to become Freedom Parkway. And
being a landscape architect, he thought, well, this could be a lot better.
I felt like it had way too many straight lines, and I called
beautiful
Kathy
with curves, meandering, and rolling hills, and really making it more scenic.
So we had several meetings down with the DOT.
Together, working with the Department of Transportation,
the commissioners,
they were able to create the park that we see today.
Now, were they happy to see, or were they like, all right, enough of y'all?
No, there were some red faces sometimes. It would get a little difficult at times. But we wanted to see this meandering roadway, and we wanted to add curves in every place we possibly could. And the road does curve. With the exception of a couple of places where it goes under bridges or other structures. But a lot of curves were added. A lot of trees were saved. There was a lot of additional grading for the road to follow the contours a lot better than it would have, I think, without our involvement. So the design process took quite a while for the roadway itself. And I really think it turned out pretty well. And once the road was built, things started to change pretty rapidly. The feel of the neighborhood changed almost immediately. It was really fun to watch that happen.
From a design perspective, you can enter Freedom Park just so many different ways. And that's a wonderful thing for parks because we want people in them. And the easiest way to get people into parks is, you know, make sure we have as much entrances as possible. And as you said, it connects so many different communities and so many different resources. And that in itself is unique. But I look upon it as something kind of as a model for what the Beltline. If you can imagine taking Freedom Park, which is about 5-6 miles long, and then stretching it 22 miles and wrapping around the city of Atlanta. That's what the Beltline can be. And so it's just a wonderful visual.
The Freedom Park is also a parkway demands that the art be able to reach both pedestrians and drivers.
We experience the world on different scales. And my best example is if I'm in a car, I'm driving by, I might not even notice the trash on the side of the road. But if I'm on my bike and riding by, well, I'll notice it. But, you know, I really hate getting off my bike to pick up trash because I'm going along, but I'll notice it and it has an impact on me. If I'm walking, well, I see that trash. I have the time to pick it up and put it in a trash can. And that's a kind of a negative experience of litter in the park. But it's the same thing with, say, art and what have you. If you're in a car and you're driving by, you need art that can somehow be accessible and visual as you're driving by at hopefully 35 miles an hour. Then how do I interact with that if I'm on my bike or my rollerblades or my skateboard or whatever coming down? Because Freedom Park really is a transportation park when you look at it with the trail and the road. And then if I'm walking, how do I interact with that? And so it's a very difficult question. It's a challenge, actually, for the arts.
It may be surprising that a space that's equal part park and parkway is also designated as Atlanta's Art Park. In fact, Freedom Park is punctuated at both ends by two of Atlanta's most prominent sculptures honoring freedom, Homage to King by Xavier Mendina and The Bridge by Thornton Dial. Patricia Curlin, an architect, was one of the people chiefly responsible for bringing the Homage to King sculpture to Atlanta.
We wanted to build it in the United States, so I started talking to shipbuilding companies over in Alabama and Birmingham because there had been major shipbuilding and other steel works for many years in those areas, but most of that has declined, so they were not able to work with that size piece. And I talked to companies out in Washington State and a company up in Connecticut called the Electric Boat Company that builds submarines. And when they're not building submarines, they're making these large pieces of sculpture for different artists. But our budget was pretty modest for all of the artwork, so it actually worked out better for the piece to be fabricated in Europe, which it was in the southern part of France, put on a cargo container and shipped across the ocean.
That's why I'm marching, yes, I'm marching, marching down freedom's road. Ain't nobody gonna stop me, nobody gonna keep me from marching down freedom's road.
The Homage to King sculpture is perched at the corner of Boulevard and Freedom Parkway, holding the most commanding and striking view of Atlanta's skyline. It is a setting that not only projects the importance of Martin Luther King Jr., the man, but also elevates the idea that he championed and died for, the idea of freedom.
That's why I'm marching, yes, I'm marching, marching down freedom's road.
It was one solid piece. He outlined the figure, and then they used this kind of stitching process to cut holes in it, almost like a pizza pie cutter kind of, or a wheel that's used in sewing to make marks. In this case, it was kind of stitching holes in it, and then they eccentrically rolled it, and then they cut out the piece, and then the remaining part was rolled again. Depending on how you're looking at it, you're either seeing one of those curves or two of the curves, and the actual thumb and ear were then welded on later, and that gives it kind of more three-dimensional depth. I mean, it's a very welcoming piece, and it's a very elegant piece.
United we stand, divided we fall. Let's make this land safe for one and all. I've got a message, and you know it's right. Black and white together, unite and fight. That's why I'm marching, yes, I'm marching, marching down freedom's road. Ain't no fascist gonna stop me, no Nazis gonna keep me from marching down freedom's road.
I think it's both a selfish and a selfless thing to do to get involved in parks. It's selfish because you're going to benefit personally because you're going to have that better park that you can use, but it's also selfless because you're improving the greater community. You're improving your city. You're making the world a better place. And so that's, I think, is really that social movement you were talking about. That's what it's about. It's a selfish and yet a selfless movement at the same time.
Thank you for listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'd like to thank my guests today, Kathy Bradshaw, George Dusenberry, Patricia Curlin, and David Blackley. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Perkins & Will. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. See you next month.